Welcome, everyone, to the Zojo Talk podcast. I'm Paul Lefever, the Zojo developer evangelist, and my special guest this time is Norman Pilardi, the Zojo senior engineer. Welcome, Norman.
Hi, Paul.
And I want to give Norman a moment to give us a little bit of background. He's been using Zojo for a really long time, almost probably longer than anybody, and he's been working for Zojo for a very long time. So, Norman, how did you end up using Zojo, and how'd you end up working for us?
Well, I first stumbled on it in about 1996 or so, when it was still in development under the name of Cross Basic. I was working at a local company, which I'm sure has become fairly infamous now. It's called TransCanada Pipelines. I'd done a bunch of work for them over the years, and I was back on a contract, and they needed a few little utilities to help manage some of the machines I was looking after. And I thought, you know, I know C++, and I know C, and I know all these things, and I know 4D, but I wanted something that was a lot easier to find. So I went looking around. I stumbled on this tool, and I managed to write a few little utilities to help me do my job and to help our users with their jobs. And I've been using it ever since and watched it evolve through Cross Basic to Real Basic version 1.0 to, you know, Real Studio, and now on to Zojo. And that's been, I mean, it's almost 20 years now.
Wow, yeah, that's a really long time.
I think the only person I know of for a fact that has been using it, well, that maybe has been using it as long, but I know he was the first buyer, was John Balistrieri at Tin Rocket. He was the first person to buy a version, and so he's been using it in that same time frame. There just aren't a lot of people who've been using it quite that long. So
right. Well, in my case, I wasn't even a Mac guy that far ago, so there's no way I would have even heard of it or seen it.
Yeah, at the time, it was a Mac-only product. It was, Andrew Berry developing it all by himself. And, it didn't have all the things it has today, but it was still useful enough to, you know, attract a bunch of attention. And then, you know, Jeff and his company, they bought it and formed Real Software, and the rest is history. How did I, and, you know, from there, they had conferences. I met Aaron. I met Mars. I met Joe. I met all those people. And we became reasonably good friends. They'd had a couple of rounds where they were looking for engineers. And I thought, gee, it would be a neat company to work for, because I do like working for a smaller company. But the requirement had always been that you had to move to Austin. And so, you know, I talked to Aaron about this, and I said, you know, I would love to work there, but I'm not moving to Austin. I mean, from a Canadian, that would be a huge change, and my wife wouldn't move and whatnot. So I continued to just be a user. And then about 2007, 2008, I guess, in the fall of 2007, they posted again saying they were looking for engineers. And I wrote Aaron and I said, should I apply for this? And he said, please do. We kind of would like to hire you. And so I applied. And this time there was no requirement, because they'd started to move to virtual offices. I knew Aaron was in, he was still in Minnesota.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Minnesota. Yeah, he was still upstate there. Joe was in Denver. Mars was in Seattle. So they really started to be more comfortable with the, you know, working remotely. So I applied and I got the job, and I've been here ever since. I mean, it's going to be 6 years.
No, it couldn't be more than that.
2008.
Okay, 2008.
It feels like longer than that.
Time flies. Yeah, and for people that aren't aware, Norman is in Canada. Somewhere in the Great White North. I every time he says a location, I keep forgetting to go look it up on a map, because it's not an obvious one to me. But
yeah, the only way you find it is to get the GPS coordinates, because it's a very tiny little town, and I don't even live in the town. My neighbors are quite literally cows on one side, and last year it was a field of barley on the other. I mean, I have no immediate neighbors. It's really quite nice, but we have decent internet speed, so this is where I live.
Well, and that's a little bit surprising that you get decent internet speed being, you know, that remote from things. Around here, if they can't run a wire to your house, or if it's too far, I should say, to run a wire to your house, they'll want to charge you an amazing amount of money to do that.
Before we bought this house, I mean, I had grown up in the city, in a fairly large city. It's a city of about 1.2 million people now, called Calgary. And both my wife and I had grown up there, and our oldest daughter was college age, so she was going to be going to college. And I wasn't working for anybody in the city of Calgary. I was working for Open Base on a pretty full-time basis at the time and contracting to a few other companies, but they were all remote. And so my wife looked at me one day and she said, you know, our daughter's going to be going to college up here in rural Alberta, a little college called Olds College. And you're not working for anybody, and I would really like to live in the country. So we started looking for a house. And I told her, if we move to the country, I have to be able to get a good internet connection. So that is, she said, you know, no problem. I get that that's a requirement. So we not only hunted for a house, we hunted for an ISP at the same time. Because wherever we wanted to be, it had to be able to get a decent internet connection. And we found a little company out of Olds. That was doing rural directional wireless. And it's basically 802.11, same as you'd use in your house, but because of the way they shape the beam, instead of getting the signal going all over the place, you get a tight beam. And my I actually have a 90-foot tower on my property that relays to one of theirs, and I'm kind of the local backbone provider for them out here. We have about 20 people that use my tower to then get service back to theirs. And I can get up to 10 megabits, which is pretty decent considering it's wireless internet. And, you know, they rent space on the tower, and so I don't pay them much for the service. But yeah, it was nice to be able to find that and find a house that we liked, and, you know, the kids could go to school. And yeah, I can't imagine living back in the city anymore, which is really, I mean, I grew up, I never would have thought I'd live here, but I do.
Well, yeah, that's just quite a culture change. Yeah, I'm surprised about that internet type. I've never heard of anything like that. It must be pretty flat up there then for that sort of thing to work.
It's hilly, which is why I have a tower, which is why I have a 90-foot tower. There's a lot of small rolls in the landscape, but because I have a tower, people can see the top of my tower even if they're in one of these littler depressions. So there's a lot of people who couldn't get any other kind of internet unless it was satellite, and that was really expensive. This company that provided it wanted, you know, like $160 or $170 a month, and the speed was horrible. And now,
yeah.
You know, $40 a month and get, you know, 3 or 4 megs. So it's worked out really well for us. But yeah. And there's actually several companies in and around the area that do this now, but, you know, certainly hills provide a really, really interesting challenge. So they either have a tower mounted on the top. There's another company that has a really big tower over here with a blinker on it and everything. And they use it so they can relay up and over the hill that's basically behind my house.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would ever work around, at least where I am. I think there's just too many trees and too many hills that may not be feasible.
Well, yeah, mine, the reason the tower here had to be as tall as it was to clear the trees, because I have trees that are 60 feet tall. And so to get above the trees and to provide, you know, a decent line of sight, et cetera. So I do from that tower, which is 50 feet outside my house to my house, it's wired, but everybody else is basically wireless to the top of that tower that then relays it back to their building. And so the 90-foot tower, makes all the difference in the world. And I said, they've probably got 30 or 40 towers that they do this with. They've got something like 4,500 customers, and they're all rural, you know, rural people who can't get anything else. I mean, when we bought the place, the guys were on 56K dial-up.
Ouch.
So yeah, try doing this on a 56K dial-up. Ain't happening.
Yeah. That's not going to work. That is not going to work. Yeah, I mean, I was running. I have, you know, I'm in Maine, so everyone is like, oh, well, everything in Maine's rural. Like, well, no, not really. I mean, yeah, there's not a lot of people here, but I am in a technically a city, and I do have neighbors I can see and stuff, actual humans. But, you know, we have Time Warner here, so I've got cable internet, and I just recently beefed it up to the maximum I can get. So I think I get now 50 megabits down and 5 megabits up, which is... over twice as fast as I had just a few months ago. So yeah, that's nice.
Like I said, mine, I can get, you know, 5 or 10 megs down, and that's just, they have a business plan that lets you get a lot better. The real upside for me is I have a static IP address and it's symmetrical. So if I have 5 megs down, I have 5 megs up. So it was odd to be able to find that. Because I couldn't get that in the city at the time. I couldn't get it from the cable company or the telco or anybody there. And I move out to the out here, and it's like, I can run my own servers on there? Yeah, yeah. Go nuts. Cool.
Sweet. Yeah, most of them don't tell you can do that. That's nice.
They have instituted caps recently, but my cap is 200 gigabytes a month. And I say, well, how frequently do you ever enforce that? They said, well... unless you're over 300 or 400, we don't really care. 400 gigabytes a month is a lot of stuff, even with all the crap we're doing, you know, checking in and out with SVN and all. I've even been close to that. So
right. Well, I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, actually, when you're doing development type work, you don't tend to use a lot of bandwidth. So, I mean, it's just text files mostly. So that stuff transfers very quickly. And
no, it's my wife watching Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. That's the stuff you have to worry about. It's my kids watching Netflix all the time. I'm glad we don't have a cap. So what sort of stuff is it that you work on Zojo? I mean, obviously I know, but for our listeners' benefits.
The easiest way to describe it is to say I'm the IDE guy. I do more than that, but 99% of my time is spent working on the IDE, fixing bugs, adding features. You know, those kinds of things. So everything in the IDE, I've probably touched it more than once over the course of my career here. And that really is my area of focus. You know, Greg is the web framework guy and works on that and does a lot of the server side stuff. Joe does, you know, compilers and whatnot. And my main responsibility is the IDE. So... yeah, it's
like, which is a big responsibility because the IDE is pretty large. Last I saw,
it's a lot of code. When we were talking about, you know, the hard part is how do you measure this? And without all the images and the language reference database and the frameworks, there's still like 100 and some megs of code. Like, it's an enormous pile of code. I don't think I've ever tried to actually. Well, I should say, once I counted the lines of code when you hit run, and it was crazy. There was like 200,000 lines or something. I'd have to do that again to see. But because the IDE does write a lot of code for you, that's not all code that I've typed. But yeah, it's a very big project.
Right. And for people that aren't aware, the Zojo IDE is actually written using Zojo. So it's been that way for like 10 years now.
Yeah, and, it's an enormous project. So, it really is probably it's one of the biggest projects I've ever worked on. You know, and I've worked on some really big things. It's big, it's complicated, and, you know, and it's got a long history. Like you said, it started in... let's see, the first version they released was in 2006, which was before I worked here. And so it had been in the works for probably, I was told it was about 2 years prior to that. So, you know, it's going on 10 years worth of code and 10 years worth of different people working on it. So yeah, it's big, it's complicated, and it's a mishmash of styles even. As you know, different people have different coding styles, and they've chosen different design patterns over the years. So it is it's complex. It's a fun job. Don't get me wrong. It's definitely interesting, but yeah, there are days where, you know, somebody says, you should be able to fix, my favorite saying is, you should be able to fix that really easy. And then when you go look at it, it's like, oh my, and like I said, it's just because I think people underestimate how complex it is to do what the IDE does, and make it, and yet still make the IDE look relatively simple to use. That's part of the trick with the IDE, is it's quite complicated, but it still manages to do a lot of things for people in a way that's relatively simple and straightforward.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's the thing, is simplicity is hard. It's hard to be simple about things. You have to do a lot of stuff behind the scenes so that it ends up being simple when it's what you see. But it is good to see, though, that the Zojo itself can be used to build such a powerful, complex tool as itself. It's kind of a good test bed for our stuff and to prove that everything is there is working.
Always. I mean, you know, things like, when we get to supporting Retina, you know, people have said, you know, why don't you do this? Because until we can use it in the IDE and use it well, we basically are our own testers. So, you know, when we're ready to do what we need to do for Retina, we will use it in the IDE and then say to the world, here you go, this is how it works. And we beat the heck out of stuff before we tend to let anybody else see it. I mean, you could vouch for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's you know, off, you know, we'll release stuff in betas and it will have been using it for a very long time before anyone has even seen it. So it's definitely the case. So you're the senior engineer at Zojo, right? Now, how did you come up with that title? How'd you end up getting that?
Well, everybody else has a pretty obvious, I didn't want to put IDE engineer on my, you know, tagline. And so I said to Jeff, I said, I'm going to put senior engineer on my presentations. This would have been last year for it. And he said, oh, okay. So I'm okay with that. And I said, but it's not for the reason because I'm the most experienced or because I'm the most, you know, knowledgeable or anything like that. I said, I'm putting that on there because I'm the oldest guy in the company. And so he laughed and he said, that's fine. And I really am. I'm the oldest guy in the company, believe it or not, which I always thought Jeff might have at least been close, but he's over 2 years younger than I am.
He's a spring chicken.
But yeah, I'm the old guy, so I get to be the senior engineer because I'm the old guy.
Well, that means you're experienced, so you've done lots of things. So what sort of stuff did you start your career as a software developer? Or did you kind of move into that?
Oh, man. Being my age, I've done one of everything. It feels like, I didn't originally start out when I graduated from high school. I actually had no clue what I wanted to do at the time. So I started working for the police department. I worked for them for about 5 years and that was the early 80s. And, I made a lot of money working there. It was shift work. They paid very well at the time, so we used computers at work, and I thought, gee, that's kind of an interesting thing. So I went and bought one. I had no idea what the hell I was going to do with it, but I bought one anyways. And I got really interested in this computer thing and taught myself, let's see, at the time it would have been BASIC on a it was a Radio Shack color computer. Was my first one. It was a fairly expensive little unit too. Taught myself BASIC. Found I was reasonably good at this whole programming thing. Kept using them at work and started taking courses at a local college, and I did pretty good. I kept working at the police department. I then bought, let's see, IBM came out with theirs. Texas Instruments came out with a clone. I bought a Texas Instruments Pro. Bought myself a copy of Microsoft Assembler and found I was doing pretty good at that. Then I met my current wife, my girlfriend at the time, and the company that she was working for was an insurance firm, and they wanted some software for their insurance agents to be able to write up insurance quotes really quick. So I wrote that for them. They gave it away to every North American Life Assurance Agency in North America. At first, I was told it was Canada, and it turned out it was actually North America. I got paid $85 to write this.
You didn't write all that in assembly, though, did you?
No, it was they used IBM PC 3270s, which are a really odd duck. They have this dual mode where they run as a PC or as a 3270 terminal. And so they could flip them back and forth. So you could write in BASIC and run it on the PC mode. And then they were a really weird machine. And so that's what they used. And they gave it away to everybody, as far as I know. And then at the police department, I decided I had had enough, and it really was kind of a job where either I was going to join the police department or I was going to go back to school. And at the time, the economy kind of sucked, and they didn't hire any more recruits for the police department. So I went back to school, and about a year before I graduated, I got a phone call from the police department saying, "We still have your application on file. Are you interested in joining?" And I said, "No, I'm at school and whatnot." I finished school and I've been working ever since. I, graduated and started working for TransCanada Pipelines and moved on from them to a little consulting firm in Calgary that eventually got bought up. Worked for an even smaller consulting firm after that. Worked for myself. Contracting, and then landed the job at Zojo at Real Software at the time, and now here I am. So it's been a long route to here, but I have been programming and being paid to program for nearly 30 years.
It seems like just yesterday.
It seems like forever. Yeah, I mean, the best part is it started out as a hobby, which has turned into a job that I like. So, I've done a lot of other things and I enjoyed doing them, but I can't imagine doing them forever. I worked for a while. I took about 8 months and went and worked for a local builder here. And I really enjoyed doing that, learning to frame and do roofs and drywall and like all that kind of stuff. But I can't do that for a living because I've got tendonitis and I do have bursitis and I can't do that forever. My eyesight's not good it's not as good as it was. So there are things that I can't do. I can't do finish work because my eyesight's not good enough to do it. So there are certain aspects of finishing woodwork and whatnot that I simply can't do well because I can't see the detail well enough. I enjoy it and I do it kind of as a hobby. But I couldn't do it as a living.
Well, it's good to be able to at least know how to do stuff like that. I mean, coming up is my son's, he's in the Cub Scouts, and they're going to be doing the Pinewood Derby. Right. And my extent of any woodworking is being able to carve up that little piece of pine into a car shape. And usually I get to find, and I don't even own tools. I've got like one handsaw, and like I told him we're going to be carving that thing up with a bread knife if I can't find someone that has these little cutter tools that I can use.
Go buy yourself a set of chisels. I mean, it's not expensive. I don't use mine very often, but I've got them, especially for, I need to hang doors. Well, you need them for chiseling out, the little spot where you put the hinge and the spot where you put the striker plate and all that. And it's nice to have the right tool for the job, even though, a lot of my tools I've just acquired over the years. So I have a table saw, I have a reciprocating saw, I have, and I don't use them day in, day out, but when I need them, it's wonderful to have the right tools to do those.
Yeah. When I say I don't have tools, I don't have power tools really. I've got like a drill and maybe that's about it. Other tools are mostly stuff, particularly my father-in-law, that when he comes here, he's just offended that I have so few tools. So he'll give me things, but.
Yeah. Living where we live, I need to have enough tools to be able to repair a fair amount of things. And, I've built a fair amount of things around here. This year, my projects, I've got a repair to do to our deck. So I need the tools for that. I've got reciprocating saws and whatnot. And I got a big shed that I put my tractor and stuff in, and I need to extend it. So we'll be working on that. And it's just, like I said, I just acquired them over the years. A couple I got from my father-in-law because he just didn't use them anymore. But then, you know, he had two of everything. When he passed away a few years back, we went through his garage. He had three table saws, and they're all the same. It's like, okay, I could understand if you had, you know, a 7-inch and a 10-inch and a bigger one. No, he had three exactly the same. He had six of the power, you know, not reciprocating saws, but he had three hand power saws. It's like, wow.
Yeah. You know, why is he cut wood three times as fast?
I don't know. Six drills. I mean, he had duplicates of, at least duplicates of everything. And so the kids all just, you know, when he passed away, they said, who wants what? And you could have walked out of there with three full tool chests. He was a mechanic from a long time ago. So he had, I mean, I got a tool chest full of wrenches and screwdrivers and whatnot from him. And I already had a bunch from my dad and my grandfather and whatnot. So yeah, I've got tools, hand tools like that coming out of the wazoo, but I got power tools too. So it's like, it's awesome. It's nice to have them because we have done a fair amount of construction around here. Because when we bought this house, it was in really bad shape, and so I've done a lot of renos to it too. I mean, but that's why we got it.
Right. And it looks like you have a nice dedicated office that you get to work from, which is always cool with you and your pets. I always see lounging around or wandering around back there when we're doing video chats, or even now, like. Actually, I don't see them at the moment. They were wandering back and forth. We were talking earlier.
No, they're downstairs barking at, well, they're growling at something that's outside. I can't tell what from here. So, yeah, I don't work from my store anymore. So my daughter runs the store pretty much full time. So we don't have the.
Right. Well, and for people that aren't aware, when you're referring to store, you have a dog watching babysitting store kind of thing?
It's a dog daycare and grooming salon. So yeah, there's usually a pile of dogs there, you know, anywhere between 25 to 40 dogs a day. So yeah, it's sometimes very, very noisy. And my daughter basically runs that store now. So I do work from home instead of commuting there every day. That makes a huge difference in terms of the noise level. So especially for you guys. I know Jeff always used to complain about that. It's like, those guys are barking. It's like, yeah, there's not much I can do. Hit mute.
Yeah, actually, now that you bring that up, I do remember that. You know, years ago, you would do a conference call and we'd hear it in the background, dog barking. Like, what is that?
Like I said, my daughter really has decided that for a while she was involved, but not didn't want to be the general manager and whatnot. And she is now basically running the store all the time. So it's taken a lot of that responsibility off my plate, which is fine because she was the one that kind of got us into it. So it's nice that she's decided she's going to run it. And I basically make sure it doesn't run into financial trouble and whatnot, but the day-to-day decisions and operations and whatnot are her responsibility.
Right. Well, going back to some Zojo related stuff, if you hadn't checked recently, and I'm sure most of our listeners know, because I mean, you are famous, you post in the forum all the time, and you're easily the number one. I haven't checked the counts lately, but you have the number one post count. And I think you might even like be doubling the number two person, whoever that is. And so do you like, you know, I'm always wondering, are you able to answer forum posts with like a left hand while you're working using your right hand, or how does that work?
I farm it out to my dog.
All right, the secret has been revealed, everyone, on this podcast. It is not Norman answering all those posts. It is his dog.
It's my dog. No, I actually, it's usually in between. I'm usually reading it and glancing at it while I'm working. I'm not necessarily following it all the time. I mean, and it really depends on what I'm working on too.
How many displays do you have on your setup there?
Three. So
there we go.
I have my MacBook, and then it drives two 27-inch displays. So,
all right, that's a lot of real estate there.
There's a lot of real estate there, but usually it's documentation on one, the IDE on another, and then the IDE being debugged on the middle one, and so I can see all things all at the same time. It just, I find it's really odd, but it's taken me 20 years to get back to the setup that I had when I first started working for TransCanada Pipelines. They were a all Mac shop at the time. And the very first machine I had with them, or one of the first machines, the very first, was a 2FX with three video cards. And so I sat down and I had three monitors, and that's always been my favorite setup, because it's just, you can have, you know, on a 27-inch monitor, I can have our docs, Apple's docs, the IDE, the debugger, all, I can have a whole pile of stuff going all at the same time instead of having to switch workspaces, which is just, it's never felt right to me. So that's just the way I like to work.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I've tried using the workspaces and switching, and I just always prefer to just throw up more displays. And I only have two at the moment, mostly because I have a relatively small office and a small desk, and that's all I can fit, unless I like set up what, you know, you've seen these things like in video editing, was like, I'd have to put a monitor above my monitor, like mounted on the wall, looking down at me. And believe me, I've thought about it, but.
Well, I will say this. When I started working, one of the things I didn't have was a decent sized desk. So I actually built my own desk. It's nothing really fancy. It does come apart, so we can move it relatively straightforward, but it's 6.5 feet long. So there's no problem with desk space for extra monitors and extra machines and whatnot. It's just, like I said, I like having all this screen real estate. So it's really, it was the size I decided it needed to be. And it's just shy of 4 feet wide too. So it's basically a 4x8 sheet of 3/4-inch plywood with a nice finish on it. It's pretty close to that. So it's served me well over the years. God, this desk is almost as old as I am.
Yeah, well, it's good to have a desk that you are comfortable at. I mean, I've had this desk now for a long time, relatively speaking, probably like 5 years. And before that, it seemed like I was going through them all the time, because I would just get, they weren't comfortable, or I get fed up with them, or I couldn't do my layout the way I wanted.
But. Yeah, they weren't big enough, and it's like, whatever. But I've had this, I've built this one about the time I met my wife, and we've been married just over 25 years now. So,
well, it's well built, apparently. So, of all the things you've worked on while you're working on the Zojo IDE, what would you say would be your favorite thing you've added or worked on?
It's a hard question, because the IDE is something that has evolved in many more ways than really, rather than has undergone radical changes. I guess the switch to Zojo was one of them, but I didn't do some of the UI for that. Tom and I collaborated on a fair amount of that.
Well, from me looking in, certainly it appears to me the thing you've worked hardest on perhaps would probably be the auto layout stuff in iOS. I'm eagerly awaiting your XDC session on that topic.
Yeah, the auto layout stuff is probably one of the most complicated pieces of code in there, because the IDE certainly tries to mimic what's going to happen on iOS at runtime. And so it's... the engine was written by Joe Strout, and it's been pretty solid. But yeah, the layout composition, where when you drag things around to figure out which rules should or shouldn't be, is certainly one of the harder pieces of code that I've ever written. But that's a hard question to really answer. I mean, there's been a lot of things that have improved the IDE in a lot of subtle ways, but they aren't standout notable features in and of themselves. I've done a lot of work over the years in terms of improving the reliability of reading and writing all the different file formats. Those are things
right.
constantly get mentioned. Just overall stability, they're not these big things that you can point to and say, I did that, right?
I do remember a lot of work you put into the code editor to make that a lot more stable and work a lot better.
I don't know for anybody that's listening, if you ever did any Y2K work, that's about what the work on the IDE is like in many respects. It's you do all this work that nobody sees, but it just makes things continue working either at least the same or better than they were. But it really doesn't fundamentally change what you see in front of you. So there are a lot of subtle things. The code editor was certainly one. That was a complete rewrite. And yet what people see is, yay, we still have a code editor.
Right? Yeah, it works just as it did before, except it is faster under the hood and it can do a bit more.
It does a whole lot of things better than it ever did before. And it works correctly on Coco. It's odd because a lot of the work on the IDE is that way, where you have small additions rather than huge things being added. I mean, there are from time to time big things that get added. I mean, the switch to Zojo from the old IDE was an enormous job, but that wasn't something that I did on my own. William and I worked on it. Tom and I worked on it. Greg and I worked. I mean, I've been involved with that change since it started, but none of it was, oh, that's Norm's doing. It's all
right. Yeah. It's all collaborative work that everyone had a little part of. Well, and that's why, I kind of singled out the auto layout stuff, particularly because, after you start using, I spend a lot of time in iOS a lot recently, especially with all the webinars and stuff we've been doing, and you get used to auto layout very quickly. And then when you go back to desktop and web and it's not there, you're like, nope.
The desktop and the web are going to be more challenging to add than iOS. I mean, in part because on the desktop side of things, we have an auto layout engine on Coco that we can leverage, which is awesome. But we don't have one for Windows and Linux. So we are going to have to take the engine that the IDE is using and use it for the runtime aspects there. And there are some...
Right. And when you say there's an engine we can use, you're referring to an engine built into the OS, like iOS has the engine built in and Coco does.
Right. So when we create a project for iOS, we've basically in the IDE provided a UI and an API so that you can use iOS's auto layout. And for Coco, we'll be able to do much the same thing. But for Windows and Linux, which don't have that runtime engine, we will have to actually build the runtime engine and then make it behave in the same ways, more or less the same way it does in the IDE. And the nice thing is, because it's all written in Zojo code, that shouldn't present enormous challenges, but it's something that needs to happen. And then you need to make sure that you have fidelity between the three OSs. So if I create a project on OS 10, it behaves this way. And if I create it on Windows and move it to OS 10, or I create it on OS 10 and move it to the others, that you have this consistency so that, you don't have
right. Yeah. You want the behavior to be, very consistent or even exact.
Right. And there are some, even in the IDE today, you can create a setup where it works well in the IDE. And when you look at it on an actual device or in the simulator, there are some subtle differences, and those are things we're going to have to correct. They're just right now, of course, focuses on getting to 64 bit, and there is some work that I need to do in the IDE to collaborate with Joe on 64 bit, etc. So there's no shortage of things to do, and then for the web stuff, Greg and Travis are going to have to determine how auto layout's going to work on the web even. So that's, you know, again, it'll be those guys having to build whatever framework is necessarily there. IE will have to work with that as well.
Well, it'll definitely be, I think, well liked and used, because and people will be used to it and will be like, I want my auto layout. You'll start to get chants in the forum and the conferences. We want our auto layout. And it'll be great because, I mean, right now, there's not a lot of tools that have this sort of auto layout stuff in. And
no.
It's pretty nice once you get the hang of it, and you, it's just to see your layout move around for you when you're adjusting things. And not having to write all that code, it's just so pleasant.
Yeah. And it's nice when you see some of the, even some of the examples, right, where people say, well, I want this kind of setup where, and you go, yeah, okay, so set this, like this. And there's no code, and the thing automatically does, you know, whatever it is. I mean, then we've got a very simple example there that keeps two rectangles or two squares proportioned, whether you're, you know, landscape or portrait, whether you're on an iPad or on an iPhone, and it keeps them the same size and positioned properly. And there's no code in the entire project. It's just rectangles with auto layout constraints. It's like,
right.
You know, it's a very simple demonstration of the power that you can get with that. And yeah, you can still manipulate things in code, but that should diminish as things progress. Even when you see what, Apple's doing with Xcode is, you know, they've seen where there are shortcomings and whatnot, and they've made some changes to it, to the auto layout, and we'll want to be able to track those kinds of things too, because they've spent a lot of time thinking about UI for being able to create a UI for a device that you don't know the size and whatnot. You don't know all the characteristics of the day you create it, and yet it can still work and it can still look the way the designer intended. It's a very different model than you see from everything else. Like Microsoft doesn't have anything like this, and Androids, they don't do this either. They have a much, much simpler model.
Well, Norman, I want to thank you for taking some time out of your obviously very busy, busy day to chat with me on the Zojo Talk podcast. I'm sure our listeners are going to appreciate all the many insights. Our XGC 2015 conference is less than 2 months away. And, you know, why listen to a podcast when you can just chat directly with Norman? So by all means, make sure you're there. And all engineers, lots of good sessions. We love seeing all the customers and chatting with them and hanging out. So Norman, thanks again.
No problem.
Bye, everyone.